ahead and get started. Hopefully the people will filter in. So this morning, what we will talk about is the basic concept of discriminative training. This is a extension to the maximum likelihood approaches, and it forms the basis for a set of methods involving the use of the discriminative approach for adaptation. So I wanted to spend today talking about the basic framework for discriminative training, which relies heavily on concepts from information theory, particularly mutual information and entropy. And then we'll end up with we won't derive the equations, but we'll talk about the re-estimation equations for Gaussian mixtures. And then next class, we'll talk about how this has been applied in various ways to the problem of adaptation. The material today should be a review for the students that took pattern recognition, because most of the lecture notes come from pattern recognition course, but since a number of you haven't taken that course yet, I thought we need to spend some time reviewing and building that background on this topic. There are two good resources to support today's lecture under the resources link. The second link is Dan Povey's thesis on discriminative training. He was one of the people responsible for introducing this to the field. And that's a very nice, very detailed dissertation that actually derives all the equations and all the key equations and talks about the different ways these equations can be derived. I think that's a bit beyond the scope of this course, but if you want to understand where some of the equations that we'll talk about today come from, that's one of the best resources to learn about the derivation of these equations. The second resource, this Signal Processing Magazine article, which is linked here. This is a fairly new paper, and it is an attempt to provide a unified framework for discriminative training, and this unified framework has become somewhat of a hot topic in the past couple years. As we'll see in a moment, there's three basic approaches to discriminative training, and in the past these three were motivated and derived in a somewhat separate fashion. In the last couple years, a number of researchers have tried to reformulate this problem using a common framework, and this paper in Signal Processing Magazine is one of the more recent publications that really tries to lay out that theory. I think the scope of the paper is probably a bit beyond students in this course. The paper is not bad, but I think it's pretty hard to read if you're not familiar with the material. So I'm not sure that you'll be able to read that paper and get as much out of it as I would have liked, but I think it's worth reading because it gives you a contemporary view of how we really look at this whole process of discriminative modeling in signal processing. And I think you'll see a lot more work in this area over the next couple years, since it seems to be a hot topic at most of the conferences we participate in. Okay, so let's begin. With a couple slides providing an overview of discriminative training. So there's two types of paradigms for learning statistical classifiers, what are called generative and discriminative models. We've thus far talked about generative models in this class, and today we'll begin talking about discriminative models. Generative models rely on learning the joint probability distribution of the observed features and the corresponding class membership. So in the pattern recognition problem, the most basic formulation of the pattern recognition problem is to provide a set of data, some observations, what we typically call these observations, and to then try to build a machine that predicts the class assignments associated with each one of those observations. So you may have a set of 100 vectors. Each one of those vectors has a class assignment associated with them. And the, And the basic pattern recognition paradigm is to try to build a machine that, given a vector, can predict a class assignment. And that formulation is sort of the simplest version of the problem. Now, in some problems like audio processing, we try to go a little bit further, and we try to actually build machines. We try to take into account, essentially, the temporal relationships in the data. So we don't simply just view vectors as being independent of one another. We actually try to model the temporal relationships between the vectors. And that's really where hidden Markov models come in. And that's why sometimes in this literature it's hard to separate the hidden Markov model aspects from the learning theory aspects, because the two are so interrelated. But in the speech problem, we know that these vectors occur in a particular sequence, and we know that because there's a physical system that produces these vectors, the physical system being, for example, your vocal tract, that there's physical constraints that ultimately influence the sequence, the statistics of these vectors. And we try to model that as part of the learning machine. So we don't simply look at the probability of a single vector, the probability of a class assignment given a single vector. We try to look at the probability of the sequence of vectors given the class assignment. And to model the temporal aspects of that, we use the hidden Markov model. Now, the sort of a common ground between these two extremes, the extreme where you simply build a machine that takes a single vector and predicts the class assignment, and a machine where you take multiple vectors and predict the class assignment, is the problem of looking at the overall joint distribution of the vectors. And so commonly what's done is to not simply look at single vectors, but to look at the joint distribution of these vectors. So if you're given, let's say, 10 vectors, rather than looking at the probabilities of each one of those vectors predicting a class assignment, you look at the joint probability of the class assignments given these vectors. And that's statistically a good thing to do, but the problem with that is we don't really have a good model of the joint distributions of these vectors. So that's one of the reasons why we step back to a simpler approach using something like a hidden Markov model. Now, the generative models in this framework essentially ask the question, if given a set of training data, how can I build a machine that generates data that has statistics equivalent to the training data? So the first order of business in a generative model is to try to model the statistics to build a machine that's capable of producing data that has the same statistical properties as the training data. And that's essentially done by maximum likelihood methods. The drawback of that approach is that you have to decide what are the statistics that you're essentially trying to model. And more often than not, in a scenario like this, we talk about Gaussian distributions, means and covariances and such. Well, that model in itself may be a approximation to the true statistics of the data, and therefore even with the generative models, you're limited by the accuracy of your assumptions about what statistics you're interested in. And in fact, if you want to take this whole argument even one step further, when we look at a lot of machine learning problems, one of the more fundamental questions really is the statistical approach a good model of the overall problem space? Because it's pretty clear that humans, for example, when working pattern recognition problems, don't simply use statistics like means and variances and such. So the generative models have been popular over the years because they're very, very much consistent with the way we view problems in terms of Gaussian distributions and statistics like that. But they also have limitations, that they're limited by these assumptions of the model. The discriminative approaches, on the other hand, try to direct attack the overall the problem of minimizing the error rate of your classifier directly. So with discriminative models, we look at the problem of, if you have this machine that predicts class labels as a function of data, it's going to have some error rate associated with it. And we construct essentially a function which measures this error rate. And then with the discriminative models, we try to essentially minimize the error rate directly and try to optimize parameters in the system so that we minimize the error rate. Now, one of the problems with that approach that's often not discussed, you might say, well, that's optimal because that guarantees that I will get a system which minimizes the overall error rate. However, the problem with that approach is that the error rate, the function that you're trying to minimize that represents the error rate may not be as relevant to the actual problem space as you might want. In fact, in a lot of different pattern recognition applications now, we essentially reverse engineer the performance metric, if you will. So if you give me a competition and you tell me, well, this is the way I'm going to weight various errors that the system makes, I can actually fold those weights into the minimization or the optimization of the parameters of the model. So the discriminative approaches work well, but they can be very specific to how you measure errors and how you weight errors. And often that's not really known. That's not an exact science. It depends on a lot of application constraints, how you might want to do that. So the discriminative models suffer from a similar problem, that they're only as good as your error rate metrics and such. And therefore, but given that you accept a particular parameterization of the error rate, then discriminative methods will generally outperform the generative methods because their goal is to minimize error rate. Both of these approaches, of course, suffer from what we call the generalization problem, which is that both of these approaches are very good at training on the specific statistics of the training data that they're given. And the question then becomes, how well do these systems generalize to new unseen data, especially when some of that data might not be statistically similar to your training data? And that's where the adaptation problem comes in. Discriminative systems are very good at minimizing errors on particular data sets, but they're perhaps not as good at generalizing from one data set to another data set. So it's very common in the context of discriminative systems to also use adaptation so that you can adapt to whatever new problem space you're trying to address with these discriminative models. So generative models rely on learning the joint probability distribution of the observed features and the corresponding class memberships. Class assignments are then made based on assigning the most likely class. That's what we really know as the maximum likelihood approach. The goal is to maximize likelihood and thereby indirectly, we hope, minimizing error rate. And we try to maximize the likelihood across all of the data points in the training set, not just individual data points. Generative models derive their name from the fact that the model has the ability to synthesize data with statistical properties similar to the training data. So the general approach is to model the training data and then indirectly and then be able to do classification with that model. Techniques we have discussed, such as maximum likelihood estimation and maximum a posteriori estimation, fall in this class of algorithms. What we want to start talking about today are discriminative models that directly estimate the class posterior probability. The intermediate step of estimating the joint distribution is bypassed, and that's a good thing because joint distributions generally have far too many parameters associated with them to be accurately estimated. So we always have to make some kind of simplifying assumptions to if we have to estimate joint distributions. So in discriminative training, we bypass that And class assignments are made based on direct maximization of a discriminant function or a set of discriminant functions. And the goal is to directly minimize the error rate. Discriminative training or discriminative models really actually dates back to the early days of neural networks. One of the fascinations with neural networks in the early 1980s was the fact that you could take a network, you could train it in a generative mode, but then you could also sort of flip a switch and now train it in a discriminative mode. You could tell it, here's the answers, and here's the data, learn the mapping between these, but you could also tell it, here are the answers, build me a machine that can essentially partition this space so that given data associated with one of these answers, it can put the data in the right class with respect to all the other choices that are possible. So by the mid-1980s, we were seeing this kind of N-way classification problem solved in very nice, very general ways using neural networks which were based on discriminative techniques. Now, for small dimensional problems, doing these N-way classifications is not a big deal. If you have, let's say, four choices to make, you can very easily build a machine that can look at all four of these classes and partition the space so that you essentially build decision regions. If you think of these four choices in some multidimensional space, what a neural network will essentially do is build some kind of decision surface that describes which portions or regions of this space fall into a particular class. But when you're dealing with very large dimensional problems, like speech recognition, for example, where the number of choices is effectively unlimited, you can't build these kinds of simple machines as easily. And that's why the neural networks enjoyed some great popularity in the 80s, because they were showing how they could solve several very interesting low-dimensional problems and give you sort of optimal or perfect solutions. But it was much harder to generalize those approaches to the large dimensional problems that we typically want to solve in machine learning or pattern recognition today. So therefore, what's been more successful has been applying things like discriminative modeling to hidden Markov models, and applying hidden Markov models to these problem spaces where we have millions and millions of different alternatives. And that's generally true whether we're talking about audio processing or whether we're talking about mapping of DNA sequences or any of these kinds of spaces. Generally, the state of the art in these arenas today involve some mixture of hidden Markov modeling with discriminative training. So there are three general classes of discriminative algorithms. There are the maximum mutual information approach, which we'll spend most of the time talking about today because I think it's sort of the cleanest of the sets in terms of its derivation. Minimum classification error. This is an approach that does exactly what the title says. It tries to actually directly minimize classification errors by assigning penalties or loss function associated with those and trying to minimize the loss function. Both the articles that I referenced at the beginning on the title slide talk about all three of these approaches. So if you want to learn more about the MCE approach, you'll see that in those papers. And then there's sort of an approach that's halfway between these two called it's actually called minimum phone or minimum word error. And I'll talk about that in a few slides, I'll contrast that to our MMI approach. But this is essentially an approach where you try to minimize the error rate on what are called subsequence patterns. And it was introduced in the context of speech recognition, where we tried to minimize phoneme error rate or minimize word error rate as an alternative to minimizing the overall sentence error rate. And it's general. It can be applied to almost any pattern recognition problem where you have a hierarchy of symbols, and you have your highest level symbols can be written in terms of some lower level intermediate symbols. And this is an approach which tries to minimize your classification error on those intermediate symbols. So today we're going to focus on the MMI approach. But the nice thing about when we get to adaptation, any of the adaptation problem can be cast in terms of any of these three approaches. So there's sort of no loss of generality when we talk about how we apply discriminative techniques to adaptive training. And new literature is emerging that attempts to describe all three of these approaches from a common framework, and as I mentioned at the beginning of class, that's what this most recent SP Magazine article is about. So if you read that article, it's written from this point of view, and there are a couple, it points to a couple papers that have introduced this idea in the past couple years. So now let's focus on maximum mutual information estimation, which is called MMI or MMIE. The MMI classifier design is based on maximizing the mutual information between the observed data and their corresponding labels. From an information theory perspective, mutual information provides a measure of the amount of information gained or uncertainty reduced regarding the labels after seeing the data. Now that's a very important statement, though you might, so we need to make sure we understand that. So if I give you a set of data and the associated class labels, what's the simplest classifier that you could build? So you're looking at your final exam for pattern recognition, and the professor says, here's some data, here's some labels associated with those data. Build a learning machine. Build a classifier that can produce labels given the data. What's the simplest machine that you can build? You can actually get a perfect score on that question, knowing absolutely nothing about pattern recognition. No, it's too hard. Nearest neighbor is a good concept. There's something much simpler. Much, much simpler. You're thinking way too hard. So the nice thing about pattern recognition is that any machine that guesses labels from data, any machine can be considered a pattern recognition system. Right? Right? The only thing that differentiates these machines is the error rate that they have. And I like to emphasize this because often we get caught up in the theory. And we forget that the overall point, the ultimate goal in all of this is essentially to minimize error rate in some way that benefits you or benefits your users or your customers. But almost any machine can be considered a learning machine as long as it makes some guesses about the class assignments. Now, why am I belaboring this point? Well, it really highlights this sentence that I just read about information theory. So the simplest thing to do, of course, would be one of two things. And we actually see learning machines that function this way. The simplest thing to do would be to always choose one class. And you may say, well, that's stupid. But that's actually what children do. I know many of you don't have children yet, but when the day comes when you have children,
You'll take your child to a restaurant and present your child with all these choices, and invariably they're going to choose French fries or chicken fingers or whatever, you know, whatever the child food is. They have a very simple machine. They choose the same thing all the time because that's what they know. Now, that's important to understand because over time, of course, children learn not to do that. They're actually very good examples of learning machines. And they learn that through corrective feedback. Your parents say, why do you always choose French fries or chicken fingers or pizza? You know, this is a nice restaurant. Try something else. And you play this whole game over the next 5 or 10 or 15 years of trying to get them to expand their food choices. But that's actually not a bad learning machine, because they know what chicken fingers and pizza and French fries, and they like them, and for their error metric, that's actually a good choice because they will get something that they like. So it's actually not as simple a learning machine as you might think. Now, the obvious thing to do when you're given a data and you know nothing about the problem, the obvious thing to do is to choose the data that has, make the choice that has the highest prior probability. So very often in problems, let's say we have a four-way classification, the four classes are often not equally likely. Usually, and it's in a lot of, it's actually not surprising that in a lot of spaces, even if you have a four-way choice, one or two choices may actually be very, very probable. So the simplest learning machine you could build is really to either choose one class all the time or to choose the most probable class based on the prior statistics. Okay, does everybody understand that? And that essentially defines, you could say, a lower bound, an upper bound on the error rate, a lower bound on the accuracy. That's you would expect any learning machine that you build to be able to do better than that, because the learning machine hopefully is going to make use of more information than just making this a priori guess. But this a priori guess is very important because that's the bound that we often call random guessing. And random guessing, if you don't know the prior statistics, you could just assume the classes are equally likely and just pick one of the four classes at random. But you can do a little bit better by looking at the most probable, the prior probabilities of classes. Now, you know, many of you are saying, well, that's really stupid. I didn't need to go to graduate school to figure that out. But let me tell you, when you get up to do your dissertation defenses, you better show, if you're working on pattern recognition, how your system compares to random guessing. Because there's a lot of learning machines out there that, if not trained well, will actually produce results worse than intelligent guessing or random guessing with priors. I've seen this, you know, time and time again, and it's very sobering when you spend 4 months developing a pattern recognition system only to find out that it's not as good as using this random guessing, because in a lot of problem spaces, the priors can be heavily biased towards one or two classes. Now, from an information theory standpoint, it's important to understand that as the baseline, because then we talk about the learning machine as essentially information gained or uncertainty reduced. The goal of a pattern recognition problem is to reduce uncertainty between the class labels and the data. So we ask the question, so that the random guessing is sort of the prior state, and now we ask the question, well, if I give you some data, there's every reason to expect that after seeing the data, you should do better at classification. And this is the key to the MMI approach, because this essentially cast this whole problem in terms of how much information do I gain by seeing that additional data. And we can actually then go through a maximization to maximize that function. So MMI is a well-established principle in information theory, and it possesses good theoretical properties. There are strong reasons why this notion of information gain or uncertainty reduced, why that's the right thing. And this is why when information theory was first introduced in the late 40s, early 50s is when it really became a field, people were excited because it was a completely new way of looking at the statistics problem in terms of uncertainty and the reduction of uncertainty. And therefore, it's not surprising that we will in a moment talk about things like entropy and mutual information. Those are really form the basis of this approach. Now, in contrast, there's a spelling error there. The MCE, minimum classification error approach, uses a classifier that compares a set of discriminant functions. So with the MCE approach, we will often have a set of discriminant functions that describe this decision surface space, and parameter estimation then involves minimizing some sort of expected loss function associated with those discriminant functions. Popular techniques to do this kind of thing are support vector machines, which have been very popular over the last 10 or 15 years because they're very good at doing this kind of direct MCE training approach where each and every error is considered and you build a machine that tries to drive the error rate to zero. And machines like support vector machines can, for a given data set, produce zero classification errors. But you pay a price that approach may not be completely general. So when you try it on a new data set, you don't get as good performance as a technique that tries to sort of generalize. The maximum a posteriori approach, actually that should be the MPE and MWE approaches, minimum phone error, minimum word error approach, is somewhat specific to sequential estimation problems such as speech, and instead of minimizing the overall sentence or string of symbols error rate, the approach is to try to optimize performance at the substring level. This gives you a much more tractable training approach, and in practice produces a pretty good error rate. And in problems like speech recognition or DNA recognition, DNA maps, we have an overall model for how we put the substrings together to build sentences, so we can leverage that model to get us from substrings to sentences. So it's sort of a suboptimal approach, but it solves a lot of the computational challenges of the true MCE approaches, and therefore it's been pretty popular in the last few years. All three approaches can be mapped to an objective function in a canonical rational function form in which the denominator term is constrained to be positive value. I won't say too much about this today, but we'll actually use a function of this form with MMI. All of these approaches essentially deal with looking at the posterior probability divided by the overall evidence, and try to essentially maximize some aspect of that function. So when Baum-Walsh algorithm originally postulated what's known as the Baum-Walsh algorithm, it was initially proposed for functions that were just of polynomial form, but then he later extended it to what's called the extended Baum-Walsh algorithm, where they could deal with this ratio of two functions, or rational functions. And if you read the Signal Processing Magazine article, they spend a lot of time talking about this, and they're actually, because they try to cast all these approaches as a problem of optimizing a ratio of two terms, and that's sort of why that's what they call a canonical rational function form. Much of the work that we're going to talk about today dates back to the late 60s, and it's taken a while for people to really understand how to apply those concepts to the machine learning problem. But it's interesting that algorithms like the Baum-Walsh and extended Baum-Walsh, which are key to the discriminative training type approaches, these were actually devised originally in the late 1960s. Okay, so having said all that, we can sort of quickly go through the MMI approach. So we're going to work in a discrete random variable space, though we'll actually end up with re-estimation equations for the continuous case. But the reason we work in the discrete space is because we're dealing actually with class assignments now. Since we're trying to directly minimize error rates, that's, you could say, in some sense, a discrete problem because we have class assignments. You might have a four-way choice, so you have four classes. So what you're going to try to minimize is some function of these four classes versus trying to simply maximize a likelihood, which is a continuously valued function. So the entropy of a discrete random variable is defined as the sum over all possible outcomes. So the variable will be x. X is a member of some set. Again, that set may be, for example, a four-way choice. And the entropy of this variable is defined as the sum of p of x times log p of x. And we all know that the maximum, if you're constrained in a discrete space with this function, what is the maximum, what is the p of x that produces the maximum value of h of x? So if you're in a discrete space, what's the maximum entropy distribution? Well, that's the distribution which has the least, it's the most random or the least constrained, and that would be they know the answer to this. We've got pattern recognition on this side and non-pattern recognition on this side. What's the maximum entropy distribution for the discrete case? It's a uniform distribution. What's the maximum entropy distribution for continuous random variables?
Gaussian.
So the uniform distribution for discrete space is the equivalent of a Gaussian distribution for the continuous case. It's the least constraining distribution because it just has one parameter associated with it, 1 over n, where n is the number of outcomes. The joint entropy between two random variables, x and y, is defined as the sum over x and y of p of x and y log p of x and y. Now this is on the surface a fairly simple calculation, but it does require knowledge of the joint distribution between x and y, and we often do not have access to that in a real problem, and that's a hard thing to estimate. So we tend to work in terms of conditional or marginal distributions. The conditional entropy h of y given x, and this is important in the context of MMI type estimation, is defined as the sum over x of p of x times the entropy of y given a particular value x. So this is essentially taking the entropy of y given particular values of x times the probability of those values of x and summing over all of x. And this is also just can be shown to be equal to minus the sum over x and y of the joint distribution p of x and y times the log of p of y given x. And conditional distributions are important because they begin to tell us how much more information there is. They tell us essentially how much information about y is contained in x. And that's essentially what we deal with pattern recognition problems. So the mutual information between two random variables, x and y, is defined as I of x colon semicolon y, and that's just the sum of the joint p of x and y times the log of p of x and y over the marginals p of x and p of y. And this can also be written as the sum of p of x and y times the log of p of x given y over p of x. So in one form we have the joint distribution, and in the second form we have the conditional distribution. There's an important direct relation between mutual information and entropy. The mutual information between x and y is equal to the entropy of x minus the entropy of X given Y. And at first glance, this relation might seem backwards, but which is bigger, H of X or H of X given Y? Well, think about that. H of X is essentially the ability to predict X. It's a function of the probability of distribution of X. And it's essentially with a function that has no knowledge of Y. H of X given Y is essentially measuring your ability to predict X given information about Y. And the important thing to remember with entropies is that when things are unpredictable, entropies are high. When things are predictable, entropies are low. So I think with those thoughts, you should be able to answer my question. By symmetry, it also follows that I of X and Y is also equal to H of Y minus H of Y given X. And that's because this is mutual information between these two. So we can compute that using either leading with X or leading with Y. Two other important relations: the mutual information between X and Y is equal to H of X plus H of Y minus H of X and Y. And that actually gives you some insight into what mutual information is. H of X is your ability to predict X with no information. H of Y is your ability to predict Y with no information. The joint between X and Y is your ability to, it's sort of the relationships. Everything you want to know about this, your ability to predict X and Y is held in the joint. So this is essentially, this operation leaves you with essentially all the additional information H of X and Y gives you relative to predicting X in isolation or Y in isolation. And remembering again that prediction means the entropies are low, you can see that you would hope that if X and Y were statistically independent, what would you expect this result to be? Well, the entropy between X and Y, if X and Y are independent of one another, the joint P of X and Y, the joint P of X comma Y can be written as what?
P of X multiplied
by P of Y, right? So you'll have P of X P of Y times the log of P of X P of Y. And you can then take that log and factor it into the sum, and you can then sum these independently. So think about what happens in this with this joint entropy when X is independent of Y, and then you can show what that speaks to about the mutual information. The mutual information of X with itself is just H of X minus H of X given X using this relation we had in terms of the conditionals, and that's just equal to H of X. So how do we apply this in pattern recognition? Well, given a sequence of observation vectors, which we will write observation vectors today as X's, so the set of these observation vectors is capital X, These can be typically viewed as feature vectors. We would like to minimize the error in prediction of the corresponding class assignments. And we will call those a capital omega, where the individual classes are omega 1, omega 2, through omega sub n. A reasonable approach using this notion of maximum mutual information would be to minimize the amount of uncertainty about the correct answer. That's essentially the MMI approach, and we'll show that in a moment. But what we want to do is when we make a guess about a class assignment from the data, we would like to be as sure about that class assignment as possible. So we can state this in information theoretic terms as minimization of the conditional entropy. We want to minimize because we want it to be predictable, and we want to minimize the uncertainty. We want to minimize H of omega given X. And that can be just, as we've seen, can be written as the sum over omega and X of the joint between omega and X times the log of the joint between omega and X. Now, using our relations from the previous page, we can write that the mutual information between omega and X is equal to H of omega minus H of omega given X. And therefore, we can turn this around and we can write that the entropy of H of omega and X is equal to H of omega minus I of omega and X. So we have the entropy of omega and X in terms of the entropy of omega minus the mutual information between omega and X. So if our goal is to minimize H of omega given X, then we can do one of two things. We can this is a typo. What I really meant to do here was to take this H of omega given X and move it over here. So we can write H of omega given X, not semicolon, is equal to H of omega minus I of omega given X. So if our goal is to minimize the left-hand side, H of omega given X, then we can try to minimize this H of omega, or we can maximize I of omega given, or we can maximize the mutual information between omega and X. That should be a semicolon here for the I. Now, coming back to our discussion about why children choose French fries, what is this process of minimizing H of omega? Omega are class assignments. So what does it mean to minimize H of omega? What governs H of omega? It's the entropy of the class assignments. If I asked you to compute that, what information would you tell me that you needed? Come on, that's an easier question. Come on. Don't disappoint me here. So we have this four-way classification problem. And I ask you to compute H of omega, the entropy of the class assignments. What piece of information are you going to need to do that? And don't make this harder than it has to be. Don't think about learning machines. And it's just a random variable. Omega is just a random variable. What do you need to compute its entropy? It's the distribution of you need P of omega, right? You need the probability density function. You need to know how probable each one of these four classes are, right? Then you can compute the then you can compute the entropy, H of omega. So that's your simplest learning machine. That learning machine is just to choose the most probable class. And that's why this H of omega essentially is nothing more than a measure of the prior probabilities of the class assignments. Now, for a lot of problems where we don't have that information, we will assume the classes are equal, and then this H of omega will be maximum, which means this H will, which means the conditional entropy will be maximum. On the other hand, if our learning machine chooses based on prior probabilities and the prior probabilities are not uniform, it's easy to see that that machine will always do better from a conditional entropy point of view than simply random guessing with equal probabilities. So this is another nice demonstration of why it makes sense to guess according to the priors. It will obviously do better than simply guessing with assuming random priors. But, you know, that's sort of just the very beginning. Minimization of H of omega corresponds to finding prior probabilities that minimize the entropy. And this amounts to essentially accurate prediction of the class labels from prior information. In speech recognition, we refer to this as the language model problem, the language model with minimum entropy. And we can estimate this from large amounts of data, and that's typically what we'll do. We'll collect large amounts of text data, and we will estimate the distribution, the probability of words, and then we will simply plug into this an overall probability distribution for how probable words are. Because if I ask you to build a machine that can recognize what words I'm speaking, obviously you're not, some words are more probable than others. For example, in English, articles, prepositions occur more frequently than proper nouns and things. So we can exploit that. That's effortless to exploit, and that's just the very beginning of what we do for a learning machine. Now, what we want to talk about today is this, to estimate the parameters of our model that maximize mutual information. That's essentially maximizing this second term, which then minimizes the conditional entropy, because the two are related by this minus I of omega and x. And this is what maximum mutual information estimation, or MMIE, is all about. It's maximizing this term, the mutual information between omega and x. Now, we'll work into this. Writing this mutual information in terms of conditional and joint probabilities and such. The decision rule for the minimum error rate classifier, just to contrast this, selects the class assignment that has the maximum posteriori probability, P of omega sub I given X. And recalling Bayes' rule, we can write that P of for a particular class assignment, P of omega sub I given some feature X, that can be written as P of X given omega sub I times the prior probability of omega sub I over P of X. We've seen this before. The evidence P of X is simply the sum of this term that appears in the numerator, P of X given omega sub I over P of omega sub I. Now, as we've discussed, we can ignore this evidence term, P of X, since it's constant with respect to the maximization. However, and then that's typically what's done in maximal likelihood approaches. However, during training, the value of P of X depends on the parameters of all models and varies as a function of X. And now in discriminative training, we're going to want to take another look at this and not necessarily ignore this P of X. So we can invoke the mutual information, and we can write that the conditional maximum likelihood estimate is defined as the value of X that maximizes this term. And we want to essentially build a machine that can maximize this posterior with respect to the parameters of the model. So we can invoke mutual information, and we can write that the mutual information between x and y, as we said, is just p of x and y, the joint between x and omega, the mutual information of x and omega is just p of x and omega over log p of x and omega divided by p of x and p of omega. However, we don't know this joint distribution p of x and omega, and that's very hard to estimate in practice, so we will alter this expression a little bit. We can define the instantaneous mutual information as the mutual information between the vector x and the class assignment omega sub I. So this is for any given x and any class assignment omega sub I. And we're going to write that as the log of the probability of x and omega sub I divided by p of x and p of omega sub I. If we assume equal like priors being p of x and p of omega sub I in the denominator, then maximizing the conditional likelihood is equivalent to maximizing the instantaneous mutual information. And this is what's referred to as MMIE. Now, that's a little bit of an issue, because we know that in real problems, the priors are not necessarily equal. And that's why people looked at these other approaches, such as the minimum classification error. But let's continue along this line. So we can expand the mutual information between x and omega sub I into two terms, one representing the correct class and the other representing the incorrect classes. And that's going to be key to how we do maximum mutual information. We actually want to modify the parameters of the machine so that we maximize the probability of the correct class and we minimize the probability of the incorrect classes. That's essentially what differentiates the MMI approach from the MLE approach. So we can write that this P of X can be written as P of X given omega sub I times P of omega sub I, that's the correct class, plus the sum of the same thing for all the incorrect classes. The posterior probability of P of omega sub I given X can be written as this P of X given omega sub I times P of omega sub I divided by the overall sum of these. And that's an important relation, because now we essentially have the probability of the correct choice divided by the probability of all choices. And you can, if we now go ahead, maximization of the posterior implies that we need to reinforce the correct model and we need to minimize the incorrect model. So if we divide by the numerator, we can write this as essentially 1 over 1 plus the probability of the incorrect choice divided by the probability of the correct choice. And therefore, to minimize this, we want to maximize essentially this ratio of the correct choice over the incorrect choices. And the way we do that is we can either increase the correct choice, which is what maximum likelihood training does, or we can decrease the incorrect choices, which is what discriminative training does. And in fact, what we actually do is both. We do a few passes of maximum likelihood training to maximize the numerator, then we do a few passes of discriminative training to minimize the denominator. So this illustrates a fundamental difference in MLE. In MLE, only the correct model needs to be updated during training, while in MMIE, every model is updated. That makes MMIE much more expensive than MLE, and we'll see in a moment why that is. The greater the prior probability of a competing class label, the greater its contribution to the MMIE model. And that makes sense, since the chance of misrecognizing the input as this class is greater. So we see the role that priors play in this process. Though it might appear that MMIE and MLE are related, they will produce different amount solutions for the amount of training data, for finite amounts of training data. However, they should converge in the limit when we have infinite amounts of training data. And that's another sort of important concept, and particularly with respect to adaptation, because with adaptation, we're dealing with small amounts of new training data. The principal difference is that in MMIE, we decrement the likelihood of the competing models, while in MLE, we only reinforce the correct model. MMIE, however, is computationally very expensive and lacks an efficient maximization algorithm, so we have to use a gradient descent approach. Now, this next slide condenses about 100 pages in Povey's thesis. So we're not going to go through the derivations of these results, but we can, I think now that we've seen these various adaptation schemes, we can sort of understand the significance of these results. So we're going to define our optimization problem as a minimization of this function, which is the probability of the incorrect choice divided by the probability of the correct choice. Now, this for many years, this was a stumbling block because there was really no closed form solution for this equation. So instead, what's an iterative approach is used, a gradient descent type approach is used, and there are several ways that people have done this, and we won't talk about the specifics of that, but you'll see things like H smoothing and I smoothing and various things. But generally what you have to do to solve this equation when you actually write this out in terms of something like a hidden Markov model is you're going to have to use an iterative approach. And that iterative approach relies heavily on concepts from EM, for example. So when we do this with hidden Markov models in an EM type context, what we actually get these auxiliary functions, and we have to operate on things that look very similar to the auxiliary functions we've seen for MLR and MAP. And an algorithm known as the extended Baum-Welsh is what's used to actually solve this problem. And I just like to mention that because the Baum-Welsh algorithm provides you with the ML solution for a traditional hidden Markov model. The extended Baum-Welsh algorithm provides you with the analogous solution for the MMI model and when you're dealing with hidden Markov models. And you'll see this cited in the literature, so that sort of tells you where it came from. And the interesting thing was the extended Baum-Welsh algorithm was actually developed by Baum back in the very late 1960s or early 1970s. So it was known long before discriminative training was ever introduced into the pattern recognition problem. Now, what's the punchline? Well, when you go through this gradient descent of solution to this function for a Gaussian mixture model, you can derive actually some very reasonable re-estimation equations, and I've written them here for the means and covariances. But like I said, getting the actual derivation of these, it's quite lengthy and it involves a number of assumptions. One of the more important is, as with MLLR, we assume that diagonal covariances. So if you recall, in our Gaussian mixture model, we have the overall distribution is the sum of weighted Gaussian distributions. So we have a mixture weight, and then a mean and covariance associated with each one of the mixture components. If it's a hidden Markov model, we also have a state associated with, you have a different Gaussian mixture distribution at each state. So these equations that I'm citing here actually include this information about the state. If you don't have this, if you don't have a hidden Markov model and you're just estimating the means and covariances directly, you can essentially discard the state, what's called the state occupancies, in turn, and replace them with the prior probabilities of the states. But the essence of these re-estimation equations is the same. So the mean at a state J, the mth component of that Mistier distribution is re-estimated as follows. We take this function theta sub Jm. So J represents the jth state. M represents the mixture coefficient. If you don't have states, you can just throw away the J. But we have this theta sub Jm, and then we also have that superscript num, numerator of O, and O, where O represents the observations, what we were previously calling our feature vectors X. We have that, and I'll explain more about this in a second. We have that minus the same thing, but what's called O in the denominator. We have that plus some adaptation constant D times the old mean mu, and then we divide that by the difference between this gamma superscript num minus gamma superscript denominator plus D. Okay, so what do we have here? So first of all, the terms numerator and denominator go back to this optimization that we're trying to do. Numerator refers to the probability of the correct refers to things associated with the correct class. So when, for example, I talk about theta superscript num, that's simply the whatever parameter theta is associated with, that represents that parameter evaluated for all of the correct class choices. The theta denominator refers to this term when they're the incorrect classes. So this represents all of the choices associated with the incorrect classes. Now, I still haven't said what theta is. I'll get to that in a moment. But this is essentially why this difference between theta num and theta denominator shows up is because this is a result of the fact that we're trying to maximize the likelihood of the correct class and minimize the likelihood of the incorrect class. So we're trying to essentially maximize the difference between these two. Now the gammas that appear in the denominator, it's the same kind of thing. Gamma, in general, with a hidden Markov model, represents the state occupancy. If you don't have a hidden Markov model, gamma essentially represents the prior probability of the class. And gamma num minus gamma denominator, gamma num represents the probability of all the correct choices. So it amounts to taking your data, running it through the hidden Markov model, and looking at summing up the state occupancies for all of the correct choices. How probable the states are associated when you're assuming the correct choices for the data. Gamma denominator, on the other hand, involves the state occupancies for all the states associated with incorrect choices. Now, again, that takes a little bit of explaining because we're assuming when we have some data and we process it through this training algorithm, we need to know what the true choices are and what the incorrect choices are. And that in itself is a problem. But assuming that we have that information and we can keep track of that information, this calculation essentially involves just looking at the ML solution, which are the correct choices, minus the discriminative choices, which are the same calculations for all the incorrect choices. So as long as we can associate correct choices and incorrect choices, we can actually compute these terms. And I'll show you in a moment how we actually do that computation. So the calculations are very similar, except that these calculations for the incorrect choices means we're going to have to sum over all possible incorrect choices in the model, which is, in practice, a difficult thing to get at. This constant D was originally, it's an adaptation constant, It was it's the constant associated with, and originally what was used was one value of D across all mixture components for all states. Later they actually developed, made this constant specific to each mixture component in each state. So it has a sub J, sub M subscript associated with it. But the idea is there is it's just a mixing coefficient that determines how much you weight the old estimate with respect to the new estimate. So it allows you to trade off, much like with MAP, it allows you to trade off how much you weight information from the new data with information from the prior data. Now the thetas are essentially weightings of the observation vectors times the state occupancy. So that takes into account, it's essentially a mean of the observation vectors, but weighted by the probabilities that they could have been at various states. So the theta sub jm is computed by taking the observation vectors, multiplying them by the corresponding state occupancies, and then summing those over all of time, and then over all of the states that correspond to that mixture coefficient. So this is essentially tracking how likely it was that that state produced that observation at that time. So typically when you do these calculations, what you'll do is you'll process all of the training data through the model, and then you'll have these occupancies, you'll save these occupancies for all states for all time, and then you can go back and you can construct these calculations for each state at each time, and then you average, you sum over time, and then you sum over all the states that share that distribution. So this all looks fairly reasonable, except we have one more issue, which is how do we actually know what are the correct choices and what are the incorrect choices? Well, mixture coefficients and transition probabilities in the hidden Markov model have not traditionally been estimated using discriminative training, so I won't talk about that today. There's some other details, but discriminative training has been primarily applied to the means of the Gaussian mixtures, much like we saw with MAP. Now, calculation of the Gaussian occupancies, which it means simply the probability of being in state J and component M. This is a little tricky. In MLE training, these were computed using something like the forward-backward algorithm if you have a hidden Markov model. For MMIE training, however, we need counts for both the correct model and the competing models. Now that's the way this is done. To do this exhaustively is impossible for a large system, because it would require, if you want to, let's say, recognize a word sequence, it would require calculating the probability that that particular data could have been any possible word combination in the English language. Or stated another way, if you have this four-class problem, the probability, there's for the four data points, if you know the class assignments of the data, let's say you have four class assignments and you have two data points. The right choice is going to be two particular classes. Let's say class one followed by class three for these two data points. The incorrect choice is going to be all combinations other than class two and class three, which means class one, class two, class, you know, and so forth. So it's a sort of factorial type explosion. Now imagine in a problem like speech recognition, that's an enormous space because you have millions of words, millions of possible word combinations, the space is enormous. So what's done in discriminative training is you essentially build a, what we call a lattice, but it's really a listing of all the plausible alternate choices, the n most probable alternate choices. And this can be done either at the symbol level or the sentence level. If you're dealing with sequences of two test vectors, you would have all possible combinations of two test vectors. In speech recognition, what this represents is essentially the n alternate choices for recognition of the overall sentence. So let's say, you know, the sentence happened to be the dog is, or the car is red. This would be all other possibilities. The car is blue, the car is green, and so forth. And what we actually do to get these denominator terms is we sum over the entire lattice, which contains not just only the correct choices, but also the incorrect choices. And then for the numerator term, we just sum over the correct choices. So the key difference here, to do this kind of discriminative training, we actually need to know the transcription of the data. Now I'm going to talk about this a little more extensively next class, because this is a supervised method. We have to know the answers for the new data to be able to apply this kind of training. But once we know the answers, and we have to be able to track not just the correct choices, but the incorrect choices. So we'll talk about this a little bit more next class, because there are some implementation details that are required to make this work. But it has a very nice formulation within the context of Hinn-Markov modeling, and that's another reason why the discriminative training has been so popular within the HMM framework, because it leverages things that we already know how to do in HMMs. Okay, we will pick this up Thursday.